It's Monday, February 14, 2011. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. What a difference just a few hours can make. Friday morning dawned, and at least in the United States, the news was clear. President Hosni Mubarak was refusing to leave office. And yet within a few hours, Hosni Mubarak was gone. Egypt had a new provisional government led by the military, and the world, as well as Egyptians, were wondering what is coming next. Several things have become clear. In the first place, what we had in that speech that was given on Thursday night by Hosni Mubarak was an unmitigated political disaster. The president of Egypt thought that he could speak condescendingly to his people and assured them that he had a plan for transition that would leave him in office through September and that the people should simply go home and trust him with the plan. Well, by this time, he had had absolutely no credibility left. And as President Mubarak spoke to his people responded with a giant negative response that eventually led him to leave office within hours of pledging that he would do no such thing. Now, several of the lessons to be learned here have to do with the speed of political change. President Mubarak had the support of the military as recently as Thursday night in Egypt. And yet, during the day on Friday, he lost that power at some point. The tipping point in terms of the military's confidence in their former president simply meant that his regime was no longer sustainable. Now, the other thing to learn from this looking at the streets is that Egypt is a very young nation. This was a youth revolution. Now, in one sense, most revolutions are led by young people, and in particular young men. But in Egypt, it's a different picture than you might expect. Egypt has had a high birth rate for a number of years, and yet it's had very low rates of economic development. This has led to the fact that there are a surplus of young men and a deficit of good jobs. And what these young men are demanding, what these young people are demanding in Egypt is a future. Democracy is a code word for those on the street who are looking for a better life. Now, those of us who understand what democracy can mean do know that democracy is very much a part of what most people would want as a picture of the good life. But democracy by itself is never enough. And for a political regime to be viable, it must not only be democratic, truly democratic, it must also be competent. It must also deliver on some basic promises in the social contract that a government makes with its people. As we look to Egypt and as we pray for that nation, we need to pray that the military, which is currently in control, will indeed move towards a speedy and effective transition to a competent government, a representative government, indeed a democratically elected government, and a popularly credible government. But even as we think of the military there in terms that at this point are more positive than negative, we have to understand that as many world and historical analysts have pointed out, the stakes are very high here. The odds, so to speak, of a regime change like this ending happily in short order are rather long. Recent history and a longer historical perspective come together to demonstrate that when there is this kind of toppling of a regime, what often comes in the next chapters of a nation's history, well, it's not at all expected. And generally, if not universally, not what those on the streets demanded. Now, what should we think of the Egyptian military? Well, a couple of things here are important. If you think of a regime like Egypt, you think of a culture like Egypt, where you had a one-party system of government for all effective purposes. After all, you take the last election just several months ago, Hosni Mubarak's party gained something like 99% of the vote. Well, when you think about a political culture like that, where do smart, intelligent, and effective leaders go? They generally go into the military. The military is the one thing that even a government like that of Hosni Mubarak had to value highly and reward generously. And so if you're looking for leadership in the midst of a political vacuum like this, not only in Egypt but in many other of these revolutionary situations, the military has the only credible leadership to do anything in terms of taking charge and bringing order. One of the problems with this in a Genesis 3 world, a world marked by sin and human depravity, is that once the military gets into control, it generally discovers that it likes running things. The difficulty generally is not getting the armed services to take control. The difficulty, of course, is getting the military to relinquish control. And that's going to be a real challenge. Now, at this point, I am at least encouraged by a near universal confidence in the Egyptian military as the most competent, honest, and effective unit of Egyptian society. I hope it's also committed to the true democratic transition that it speaks of here. Another lesson on the ground here has to do with other despotic regimes. It's for good reason that, for instance, the House of Saud, the royal family of Saudi Arabia, is furious about this. Because after all, there are few regimes that can top Saudi Arabia in terms of opposition to a democratic form of government. What happened in Egypt certainly is not good news for Saudi Arabia, a country that also has a very high birth rate, but has been effective mostly not only through repressive actions taken towards its population, but by the fact that it has economically bought them off. What makes Saudi Arabia different than Egypt? Saudi Arabians have a very high standard of living compared to Egypt because of the oil revenue in that oil-rich kingdom. But what happens when you can no longer buy off the political passivity of a population? The royal rulers of Saudi Arabia have to worry about that. Meanwhile, in Iran, President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad has celebrated the fall of Mubarak as a sign of what inevitably happens to Arab rulers who become cozy with the United States of America. However, at this point, it appears that Mr. Ahmadinejad has very little traction on the streets, or for that matter, the corridors of power in Egypt. What about the Muslim Brotherhood? We'll be watching that one very closely. Something else to watch is what the Obama administration learns from all of this. Over the course of the days between Thursday and Saturday of this week, the Obama administration sent multiple and self-contradictory messages. We are told by the New York Times in Sunday's front page story that the president became exasperated with his own Secretary of State and his own Egyptian ambassador. Why? Because even as the United States ambassador to Egypt and the United States Secretary of State, Hillary Rodham Clinton, were suggesting that Egypt needed to move slowly, it was clear that events on the ground were moving very quickly. And this could leave the administration looking as if it has backed a despotic ruler who refuses to leave power and will have no credibility with the revolutionary transition that follows his inevitable fall. President Obama sought, indeed, to corral the messaging mechanism of the White House in order to get one message very clear, and that was a message in support of the people. It will be interesting in coming days to see just what kind of messages those in Egypt, on the street and in the quarters of power, think they actually heard when it comes to the messaging from Washington, D.C. When it comes to other issues of foreign policy and international interest, I want to draw your attention to something that has received, I think, inadequate attention. And this is a speech that was given just a few days ago by British Prime Minister David Cameron. He was speaking to a security conference in Munich, Germany, and he said there about his own society that multiculturalism had proved to be a disastrous failure. Now, why would the British Prime Minister say this? Well, he said this because multiculturalism in Britain, a political posture to which various British governments have been committed since the 1970s, did indeed prove to be a failure. What's the failure? The failure is that there is no melting pot in Great Britain, and various immigrant communities, most especially immigrant communities that are Muslim, primarily from nations like Pakistan, have created enclaves into which, for instance, many of the British police are actually afraid to enter, and they are no longer actually a functioning part, if they ever were a functioning part, of British culture. Now, Mr. Cameron here was just stating the obvious, but it's interesting to see how the forces of political correctness have instantly begun to circle around him. Now, one other thing to watch here is that at least two other European government heads are about to make the same kind of point. Indeed, some of them have already made some of the same kinds of statements. These include German Chancellor Angela Merkel and French President Nicolas Sarkozy. Now, why have they said these things? It is because in neighborhoods, more in France and in Great Britain, as well as the Netherlands and Belgium than at this point in Germany, what you have are basically little Pakistans, little Algerias, little Libyas, not a melting point or a melting pot. Now, what you have in terms of the United States is a national motto out of many one. Now, our own effort at multiculturalism is very different by national ethos than what you find in most of Europe. And even as the Europeans now complain about multiculturalism, one thing we as Americans might note is that the Europeans have created their own problem, and largely by the fact that Europeans created their own insular cultures. And so from the vantage point of immigrant communities, Muslim or otherwise, it is very difficult to break into those communities. One of the assets of the American political and social order is that immigrants find that they can often move rather quickly into the kind of quarters of power and influence that they seek. After all, there are currently in the United States, among the 50 states, not one, but there are two Republican governors who are of Indian background. That, just as one indication of what might be different, indicates that the national motto, out of many, one, is actually more of a reality here than it is a reality on the ground in Europe and in Great Britain. But before you leave this, as you have an opportunity to track this in the media, look at how many people are simply complaining about the British Prime Minister's statement without disagreeing with it. Now, I find that a prime example of political cowardice. They're not willing to say he's wrong. They just say he shouldn't have said it. In the United States, the economic recession has taken a toll on jobs, a toll on employment in terms not only of unemployment but underemployment, a toll on housing sales and the housing market. You go across the board. The toll of the economic recession has been very high and is probably literally incalculable. But now a study is out that was done by Lifeway Research, an arm of the Southern Baptist Convention, a survey of 1,000 Protestant pastors indicating that 34% are signaling a significant financial decline in offering plate dollars just over the last several months. And one of the things that has become clear is that if you go back in history, church giving has often fallen significantly behind in terms of time the onset of an economic recession. That's something very important to know. In other words, people generally continue to give even in a time of economic recession. But at some point, the economic effect begins to have a very material impact on how people actually can give, regardless of how they might be motivated to give. And this is another reminder to us that economics does matter. It doesn't matter ultimately, but in terms of how we measure our effectiveness, how we invest in strategic initiatives, and indeed, how we support the church, it does have an impact. Perhaps one of the most important things for Christians to know is that this very pattern does exist in order that Christians can give even more sacrificially, understanding what's at stake. Finally, in terms of economic toll, you might want to consider that Borders Bookstore is expected to file for Chapter 11 protection this morning. The Borders Group, according to the Wall Street Journal, is in the final stages of preparing a bankruptcy filing. As Mike Spector and Jeffrey Trachtenberg write, they're clinching a long fall for a company with humble beginnings that helped change the way Americans buy books but failed to keep pace with the digital transformation rocking every corner of the media landscape. The shares of Borders tumbled 33% to 25 cents a share by 4 p.m. on Thursday on the New York Stock Exchange. Borders is not prepared at this time to report on the course of action it will pursue, the company said in a statement. However, close observers expect that the Chapter 11 filing could come as early as this morning. One statistic in the Wall Street Journal story, one source that was cited here, said something that I think we probably ought to mark. Mike Shatskin, chief executive of Idea Logical Company, a New York consulting firm, said, "Bookstores are going away. I think that there will be a 50% reduction in bricks and mortar shelf space for books within 5 years and 90% within 10 years. That's a fascinating prediction. And as one who loves bookstores, a rather ominous one. Many of those predictions never pan out exactly as planned. But this we should note. No one seems especially shocked by the suggestion that in 5 years, 50% of all bookshelf space in bookstores will be gone. 90% in 10 years. The bookstore is going, he said? Well, I hope not. But we'll see. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmoeller.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/Albert Moeller. For more information about the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information about Boyce College, go to boycecollege.com. I'll meet you again tomorrow for The Briefing.